Coming up on the program today, retail in all its small business, stress-inducing holiday season make or break, economic glory. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today, the 25th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are, as of right this very minute, 29 shopping days till Christmas. A more non-denominational and economically minded big-picture way to note the date would have been to say that there are 20 days until the next round of Chinese tariffs go into effect. I mention that because the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has waded into the who pays the tariffs discussion, which isn't really a discussion, no matter how many times the President of the United States says China is paying. The New York Fed is having its say with a paper entitled Who Pays the Taxes on Imports from China? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Either they're paying, the Chinese companies that export their goods to the U.S., or we are, companies and consumers that buy that stuff from China. The answer's clear, according to Gary Huffpower at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The statistical evidence is that almost entirely the taxes are paid by somebody in the importing country. That's the U.S.
The U.S. Treasury is now collecting $40 billion a year in import tariffs on Chinese goods. Camilla Yanishevsky at CFRA Research says most of that cost is not being passed on to you and me, the end consumer. Instead, it's being absorbed by the folks in the middle of the supply chain who receive the imports and sell them in stores.
There are going to be wholesalers like department stores, like Best Buy. They're the ones that are most at risk. They're stuck in the brunt of the trade war.
The added cost of tariffs is also starting to hurt small and mid-sized manufacturers and distributors that don't have any alternative to buying from China, says Dan North at trade credit insurance provider Euler Hermes North America.
What we are seeing is a very substantial increase in what we call past due reporting. Companies under some financial pressure now are slowing down their payments back to their suppliers.
North says the same problem is showing up in the agriculture economy. Farmers suffering from China's retaliatory tariffs are having trouble paying feed and equipment suppliers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The good news, tariffs-wise, is that pretty much everything that's going to be bought this holiday season is already here and so won't be affected by those December the 15th tariffs. But we are in the retail sweet spot right now, a really busy time at a time when retail is changing a lot. So we're going to be following a couple of retailers this holiday season, all small businesses in different parts of the country, and the challenges they are dealing with. Here's number one.
My name's Patty Delgado. I'm the founder of Hija de Tu Madre, a Latina lifestyle brand. So Hija de Tu Madre designs apparel, accessories, and stationery that are all Latina-inspired, and we're an e-commerce business. Today is November 20th. It is actually Latina Equal Pay Day, and it is 9:03 a.m. So our office or our showroom looked like and still looks like a hot mess, for lack of a better word. I think that as a bootstrapped business, we don't have the luxury to afford a huge Amazon warehouse or a fulfillment center. So, my workspace is right next to a bunch of like boxes of inventory that we don't have anywhere else to put. But to be quite honest with you, I'm relying on the help of friends and family to pack orders and tape and put postcards in our envelope. So, my parents are expecting a phone call any second for me to ask them this favor. So last year we had come out with a 2019 bilingual planner, which sold out in 45 minutes, which was great, but it would have been nice to sell a lot more if we would have had a better gauge of sales. So I think that was definitely a challenge that we wanted to avoid this year with our new planner drop. Definitely being more on top of inventory forecasting.
That was Patty Delgado here in Los Angeles. It's worth mentioning, by the way, e-commerce was almost 11% of all retail sales last quarter, so says the Department of Commerce. Historically speaking, of course, that goes up over the holidays. More retailers coming up later in the program on Wall Street to start a short week. What's not to love? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In our never-ending quest to make this economy and its inner workings more user-friendly, here with some buzzwords ripe for dissection.
International demand for cryptocurrencies.
That's what Bitcoin has done.
I could care less what Bitcoin trades
blockchain
for.
Blockchain is a huge area.
God bless blockchain.
Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrency, often celebrated, sometimes in the same sentence, as the new thing. But really, they are different thing. So for today's installment of our series, Kai Explains, we're going to take it slow.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
First point of confusion.
Many people think about Bitcoin as being blockchain, but they're not really the same thing.
That's Janine Hightower-Solito. She's the managing director of operations at a cryptocurrency exchange called Gemini.
Blockchain is technology.
A type of software.
While Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are applications of that technology.
Okay, now that we've cleared that up, let's talk about Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency, the very first cryptocurrency in point of fact.
And certainly by far the largest cryptocurrency that exists today.
But there's also Ethereum, Tether, Litecoin, Binance Coin, Dash, Ripple, Monero, Zcash. I could go on and on. And on and on. By some estimates, there are more than 2,000 of these things. Anybody can make one because they are essentially just
creating a digital representation of value and transmitting that value digitally.
Let's talk about value for a second, though, and what that actually means. For all its flaws, the thing upon which the entire financial system rests is trust. Trust that if I buy something from, say, Amazon, dollars will get added to Amazon's bank account and subtracted from mine. Trust that a U.S. dollar, even if I never see it, even if it's just a greenback in my digital bank account, trust that it's worth something. The promise of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is in making that transaction happen without banks, without credit card companies, without the dollar, in fact. Instead of trust, the system is built on
the blockchain.
Laura Shin is a cryptocurrency journalist with two podcasts on the topic and a forthcoming book as well.
You can think of blockchain technology as kind of like a Google spreadsheet.
A file living on the internet that multiple people can edit at the same time.
And what I mean by that is that, first of all, it is a ledger.
A list of transactions, basically.
Which I know does not sound very exciting. However, it is a very new and novel type of ledger. It's definitely improved upon the ledgers of yore.
The ledgers of yore, the old-fashioned kind, are typically individual ledgers. Each bank has a record for each of its customers. Blockchain is really different.
Now, with a blockchain, instead, you have just one ledger. And anybody in the world can look at the state of this ledger at any given time.
That right there is the thing that's important about blockchain technology. Instead of the ledger living on one bank's hard drive, it lives on everybody's hard drive. The term of art is that it's distributed across the network.
And so essentially you're replacing these trusted third parties with software.
The thing about blockchain, the trust software, is that it's bigger than just Bitcoin. Sandra Rowe is CEO of the Global Blockchain Business Council.
Bitcoin was the first and a very important use case, but blockchain itself has many, many use cases.
There are a bunch of companies, even governments now actually, trying to use blockchain for other things.
Healthcare, identity, tracking and tracing, food safety, improving government trust, allowing for people to see for themselves information in a more timely fashion.
You are going to keep hearing about this blockchain thing, no matter how you feel about Bitcoin. Speaking of which, by the way, the whole idea we started with, that a dollar has value in and of itself, Bitcoin, the world's most popular cryptocurrency, remember, has lost $3,000, about a third of its value, in the past month. Remember, foreign exchange trading, which I think Bitcoin qualifies as, carries significant risk of loss. You might have heard that someplace. Tell us what you want explained next. Hit us up on Twitter. The show is at Marketplace. I'm at Kai Ryssdal, K-A-I-R-Y-S-S-D-A-L. They make me spell it. Running a small retail business brings its own particular challenges, made all the more tricky when it gets 35% of its annual income from the holidays.
I'm Kristen Talheimer Bingham. I'm co-owner of Dean Suites in Portland, Maine, and it is 2 o'clock in the afternoon on November 20th. We are into it. We are putting together orders. So there are boxes on every table. We've got tempering machines going. Those are the machines that keep the chocolate at the right temperature so that we can do the hand dipping. It's quite fun, actually. It feels very energizing. It's very energetic. In 2018, we were really elbow to elbow in our first space, and there was a kind of a bottleneck, pretty serious bottleneck for who was able to use what tempering machine. So some people actually had to wait for somebody else to finish before they could start doing what they needed to do. That's why we got the second space and we purchased a few more tempering machines. And now we're really benefiting from it because we can make a lot more chocolate. So to me, as the owner, that's how I like to see the holidays, just very busy and going smoothly.
That was Kristen Talheimer Bingham. She runs Dean's Suites with her husband in Portland, Maine. If food is your thing, by the way, not chocolate and sweets, really, but if you're a waiter or a chef or a dishwasher, we are looking for people who have part-time jobs in food service. If that's you and you want to talk to us about your job for a project we're doing, send us a note, would you? You can contact us through our website. That's marketplace.org. Coming up, help wanted.
Somebody that is in the business or knows the business well and is a fisherman.
Not so easy to fill that one, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 190 points today, 0.6%, closed at 28,066. The NASDAQ lifted 112 points, 1.3%, 86.32, record high. The S&P 500 up 23.7 tenths%, 31.33, also a high point there. Shares of Tiffany jumped 6.1% after the European luxury goods maker LVMH, it's more of a conglomerate really, not so much a maker, confirmed it's acquiring the New York-based jeweler for $16.2 billion. TD Ameritrade also jumped on acquisitions news. It gained 7.5% after confirming it's being swallowed up by rival Charles Schwab for $26 billion in an all-stock deal. Schwab up 2.3% today. Uber down 1.5%. You might have heard that London news. It's having permit problems over there. Karma being what it is, ride-sharing competitor Lyft up 5.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I guess I should have said this in the numbers, but if you ever doubted, we have an editorial and underwriting firewall. Today should have settled it. I didn't know that was coming. Charles Schwab and TD Ameritrade, you ought to know, are or have been underwriters of this program. All right, moving on. You might have noticed it's been a big week or so for car companies. A lot of new models being rolled out. Tesla and that truck and a launch that inspired, well, it inspired a whole lot of memes, really. We had the CEO of Ford on the show the other day talking about the all-new electric Mustang SUV. Not coincidentally, it is sort of the season of new cars because we are right smack in the middle of the Los Angeles Auto Show, held in downtown LA every year, a couple of dozen short blocks from Marketplace World headquarters. So I went down to check it out the other day and to have a chat with Lisa Cash. She is the CEO and owner of the LA Auto Show.
So this is the 2019 LA Auto Show.
This is going to sound stupid, but this is a lot of cars.
It's a lot of cars. We've got about 1,000 cars here.
All of them very shiny and buffed and ready to go.
And as you can see, it's very different than it used to be with all of the activations, the VR over here,
oh, yeah,
the rides. You know, we're in a different era where it's not passive.
So these are interesting times for car makers, right? There are a lot of challenges. There's the electrics, there's the tech we talked about. There's just sales overall and figuring out what Americans and global consumers want to buy. How's the car show business? I mean, are you sold out, for instance?
The car show business is challenging right now.
Huh.
I think we in LA are very fortunate because, first and foremost, we're the number one market.
Yeah.
And so the auto manufacturers, they want to sell cars here in LA, and so it's important for them to be here. We're number one with the electric vehicle, the environment, luxury. So we are less challenged than the other auto shows, but certainly auto shows are going through a transformation, as is the entire industry.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned electric, and it's also interesting that there's this big, giant Ford thing smack in the middle, so they've got the prime space. Because we had Jim Hackett from Ford on the other day about the new Mustang, the electric Mustang. And he chose to come here, not literally in his backyard. In fact, let's walk to the Mustang, shall we? Because I'm sure it's here somewhere. What do you make of that? Did he call you one day and say, hey, Lisa, we're coming to you?
You know, we were pleasantly surprised to have the Mustang.
Yeah.
It is such a beautiful car, and it really represents all of the changes that are taking place in this industry and real indicative of where we're going.
All right, let's go this way and get away from the sound, and I have some more stuff I want to ask you. So this is kind of a loaded question, but I got to ask it. In 10 years, right, given the way transportation is changing, is there still going to be an LA auto show?
I believe there will still be an LA auto show. You know, we are so uniquely positioned in that we have always gotten ahead of the trends. You see a company like Tortoise. Basically, they are the power behind autonomous movement of the e-scooters. So, for instance, if you want a scooter, it'll come to you autonomously. So it's like things are changing so rapidly, but we are bringing them here to the show, to Automobility LA. We have the exhibits here and the executives who are talking about them. So, yeah, I think in 10 years we will continue to be the leader in the future of transportation.
Yeah. When you talk to the people running, not just the car companies, right, but the mobility companies and the scooter companies and what have you, what are they looking for from you? Because fundamentally you're a service, right? What service do you provide them other than opportunity, or is that enough?
I think the reason that the micromobility companies are in the show is because everything is a collaboration. And so they're here to network, they're here to showcase their new technologies, and the OEMs as well need to collaborate. So you see something that was not so prevalent even 5, 6, 7 years ago, certainly 10, 20 years ago, there was not a lot of collaboration. There was a lot of silos. Now that doesn't work.
How did you come to be in this business?
Well, it's sort of a family business. My grandfather was in the automotive, the auto show world for about 60 years. He started in Chicago and then got involved with a number of other shows, Miami, Cleveland, L.A., and he brought me in about a year out of college. My mother actually made me come work for him.
She did?
She did.
What did you want to do? You were like a computer science major,
right? I was
major,
a computer
right?
science major, yeah. And tech is my real passion.
Well, cars and tech now, I mean, that's like they're converging.
They have converged, and it's wonderful. Yeah, so it's really interesting now. As we see that convergence, it gets more and more interesting every day.
Thanks very much for your time, Lisa. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've got the rest of that interview on our Corner Office podcast. You know where to get it, I assume. And if you want to see what the show actually looked like, yeah, we can do that too. There's a video on our YouTube channel. It's Marketplace APM. Check it out and subscribe while you're there, would you? A brief lesson in corporate governance now, if we might. The CEO of a company runs the company. The operations and sales and marketing and all of that are fundamentally her responsibility. The chairman of the board runs management, making sure they've got their eye on the ball. For a long time, though, in a lot of companies, one person has had both jobs. But that does seem to be changing, especially for companies in crisis. Thomas Greider wrote about that for the Wall Street Journal the other day. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
I imagine some really long-term CEOs, Jeff Immelt at General Electric certainly comes to mind, Jack Welch before him, Randall Stephenson at AT&T, they have in their combined roles a disproportionate amount of power to then mold things as they see fit.
I think that's right. As the chairman, they're going to play a role in who is going to join the board. They're going to play a role in the things that come in front of the board. So they will gain a lot of power.
All right. So let's take a use case here, to coin a phrase, Boeing and its CEO, Dennis Muilenburg, was until relatively recently the chairman of the board and the CEO. Boeing, which as we know is having some problems, came out not too long ago and said, oh, look, we're going to separate these two. Crisis management or a sudden realization of good governance?
Probably more crisis management. I haven't heard any language around Boeing permanently going to this kind of structure. They've talked about needing Dennis to really focus on the issues at the company. Mm-hmm. And so they've made their lead director, Dave Calhoun, oversee the board and make sure management is doing what it needs in order to fix the problems that they're having, which is the 737 MAX.
Right. So let's stay with Boeing for one hot second here. Mr. Muilenburg, it looks like, is going to keep his job, but based on what the chairman of the board has said publicly. But is it fair to say that this was a slap on the wrist and a punishment, if you will, short of dismissing Mr. Muilenburg?
That is certainly how people interpret it,
yeah.
Which is kind of interesting, right? Because it implies that this is an entitlement or a reward, mm-hmm. and taking it away from them and is a punishment. And if it's a punishment to have good governance,
right,
that's kind of a tricky thing.
Right. Well, so to that point, does separating these roles, I mean, I'm sure some academic has done these studies, right? Does separating the roles improve performance and, in essence, the bottom line?
That's the question. That is like the core of what you should be talking about. And it's really not clear. There is a study or two that people point to that say shareholder returns are higher if you separate. But you can think about it just rationally. It's very hard to isolate the inputs into shareholder return and to really determine that this one factor will swing on the setup of the board and the executives.
Thomas Greida covers companies and industrials and conglomerates and everything for the Wall Street Journal.
I cover General Electric, which has the combined CEO and chairman.
There you go. Until they decide not to, right? I mean, you know.
Until they decide not to.
Tom, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Kai. I appreciate it.
Last on our admittedly short tour of retailers today, a business that's been going for about 46 years selling fly fishing gear.
This is Gary Merriman. I'm the owner of the Fish Hawk in Atlanta, Georgia. It is 11:33 a.m. on Friday, November 22nd, 2019. It's pretty slow at the moment. We usually don't get a lot of Christmas shopping until after Thanksgiving. We have already prepared pretty much for Christmas. Most all of our orders for inventory is in stock and displayed. A lot of the stuff that I order for holiday retail with some of my suppliers, I actually have to order almost a year in advance. I would think our biggest challenge is just being staffed properly. And I'm not looking for somebody just to ring up people at the cash register, because most of our customers come in, they are wanting hands-on help, you know, what to buy, where to use it, how to use it. That type of information is only going to come from somebody that is in the business or knows the business well and is a fisherman.
That was Gary Merriman. He's the proprietor of the Fish Hawk in Atlanta, Georgia. More to come from him and the others we heard from today in a couple of weeks. This final note on the way out today rooted firmly in our belief that context matters. We talked real quick about that Tesla truck the company unveiled the other day. 200,000 people have put down $100 deposits to buy the thing, about which, 2 points, Number one, we have no idea how many of those deposits are actually going to turn into orders and actual purchases of said truck. And B, really what you got here, people, is a $20 million interest-free loan to Elon Musk and that company. Guaranteed, by the way, that promised 2021 delivery date slides at least a couple of years. Okay, we're out. The Dow up 190 today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ lifted 112 points, 1.3%. The S&P 523 points to the good, 0.7%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.